History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to take a few simple steps, like asking a few questions, being patient enough to listen. And you know, it's amazing how much can be added to our perspective and our understanding. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The centenarian we get to meet today has a connection to a moment and a weapon that changed the world. We're going to get to that, but of course we want to start at the beginning in a place now known as America's Medal of Honor City.
Well, I just have to think there's not anybody in Pueblo, Colorado who can give me a better history lesson than 101-year-old Bruce Elson. Your home is a museum, but for many years you volunteered at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. See a picture right there of you and Bill Barrett, who's been on this show before. Bruce, take me back. How far back do your memories in this city go?
Well, about 2 or 3 years old, because I was born at the 1700 block on East 7th, and the streetcar to carry the steel workers back to work from the east side made the turnaround to go back right at the corner of where I lived. The operator of the streetcar had to get out and change the trolleys to get going straight. And on Halloween, those ornery kids in the block would pull the trolley off of the wire, and he'd have to get off and get on, get off and get on. Felt sorry for him. But he finally got it. I took the steel workers from my block clear over to the CF&I. And people who went to work for CF&I, you knew you had a job until you were ready to retire. But then when CF&I sold out, then that all changed.
You've seen all the changes in this community, and a lot of people here probably had their cars fixed you when you were at Vidmar Mathis here. You've got a practical Oldsmobile Museum in your basement as well. And we're going to talk about World War II, but I want to go back before World War II. Those Depression years, what do you remember about those days, and what kind of perspective can you give us who didn't live through that time?
My dad, he was a letter carrier. When we'd go visit relatives and friends, that's what he wore. He didn't have enough money to buy dress clothes. It was sad to walk down the main street of Pueblo and see those men sitting there with the cups with different things in it. Never say a word, but just sit there and hopefully somebody would pick up one and drop a few coins in for him to take care of him and his family. So that really bothered me. And you know, Halloween was just starting when you'd go out for trick-or-treat to the neighbors, and my folks said, "You're not going. Those people don't have enough money to buy food for their own table. You're not going to go asking them for candy." And so I never went for trick-or-treating in my youthful days. And I'd walk around the street. Some people didn't have enough money to have electricity in their homes, so they had the lamps on the tables in the different rooms. And it was just really sad to see the condition, but probably I was young enough that it really didn't impress me like it would today.
And I can tell you've got a really good memory. Do you remember as a boy having some dreams, some ambitions, some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
I sure did. I built model airplanes. You buy the kits, and I build those that are coming out of my ears. That was my biggest hope, that I could. Then some of the guys that had a little more money, they built the ones with a gasoline engine, and they would take them out of the local airport and fly them, but they had no way of controlling them, so they'd have to go chase them down when they run out of gas. My biggest hope that I had could acquire enough money to build a model like that and go out to the airport and fly them, but that never happened.
But I understand you did get a ride in an airplane as a young boy.
Oh, yes. The Ford tri-motor that Ford Motor built came to town taking people for rides. My grandmother, she was homesteaded in Oklahoma when the Indians were still around, and they'd hide in their outside door when the Indians would get restless, and their ranch was on a deep cliff below. There were a lot of caves there, and the robbers would come by and knock on the door and tell my grandmother to fix them a meal that they were hungry. So she said that she was scared to death, and she did that for them. And when they left, there was a $20 gold piece under the plate. But they would hide in the caves along the drop off of the river below. And when I'd go down as a youngster with my folks to visit, the uncle that still lived on the farm and was just walk around on that farm. And so vivid the memories that grandmother would tell me that happened with the Indians and robbers.
And she's the one who got you in that Ford tri-motor? How old do you think you were?
I was about six. The trains used to run excursion trains to here and there in the mountains, and we'd go on those, and boy, what a treat that was. And then when the airplane came to town and landed out at the airport, which is by the fairgrounds now, she said, "You and I will take a ride on that airplane." And my mom and dad said, "Oh, no, we might lose both of you." But we got on, and I think the fee to take the ride was around 50 or 75 cents. And we toured, circled the city, and made it back okay. And you couldn't hear each other when you talked with the noise of those engines. And I never will forget that ride with my grandmother, and that is very strong memories for me today.
And you had a little military experience even before World War II, because you were in the ROTC at Centennial High School?
Every boy from the sophomore year to the senior year had to wear Army clothes. We had a colonel that headed it. Colonel Branson was his name. And then we had two sergeants, Army sergeants, and we had a rifle team as well. And so I made the rifle team, and we went to state one year to fire against the other high schools with ROTC, and we ended up in second place for the whole state. And the city had a firing squad that they took pride in, and we even beat the city with the scores that we made.
And all of this is before Pearl Harbor, and you graduate high school in 1941, so that's before the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm guessing you probably have a memory about that day, December 7th?
We were in Canyon City on December the 7th, and my brother and I, the people we were visiting, were real close to the Arkansas River. So we went down to play in the river and throw rocks in the river and have a good time. And then when we got back to the house, they told me the news that Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, we had no idea where Pearl Harbor was or anything about it. It was such a tragedy for those in the Navy that were there, and even one or two of the pilots that flew airplanes took off to try to shoot some of their fighters down, but they were quickly shot down before they could hardly get started. I had a cousin by marriage that was there on that date, and he said he was on a destroyer behind the Oklahoma, and he could hear the men that was trapped in the shell of that ship and not pounding on the floor of the ship and trying to get them to drill holes so they could get some oxygen to live, but the steel was too hard and they'd had nothing to drill through, and so all of those men died with lack of oxygen.
We had a gentleman on this program once who was trapped for a day and a half, and they finally got him out, and they said maybe 15 minutes of air left at that point. So Pearl Harbor happens. For those of us who didn't live through that, can you help us understand how much of a shock that was, or how much it changed everything for you?
Oh, yes. It changed the whole world. We ended up with everything rationed. You couldn't have too much gasoline. Some foods we used we could not get. And it just changed the way the whole U.S. lived. And no tires, no automobiles made. So it was very difficult for the people to live during that period of time. And until we had enough people to start fighting the Japanese in island to island. And it was sad, those Marines that fought island to island, all the casualties. And I read about a medic, and he said he would run from hole to hole to try to save those men that were shot and bleeding to death. And he said then the Japanese would come along and just cut them up. And I wondered why they didn't bother him. And he said that the thing he could figure, the Lord was on his side.
Well, sounds like he's been on your side too. But I'm curious as to your motivation. What made you want to be part of this war effort and sign up to serve?
Well, when we found out and President Roosevelt declared war in Japan, you couldn't get hardly to the recruiting offices for flying airplanes and different things. And I was just overlooked because I wore glasses and my eyesight wasn't 20/20. So I had to just stay and went to college a little bit here in town and till we were assigned. Everyone had a serial number, and which I still remember today, 37, 34, 26, 74, and that's how every GI was called and recognized. Then they'd call you by your number, and that's when you'd go off to war. As soon as I turned 18 and got in that line to be called, I volunteered right now to be one of those that would be called, and I was, and went to Fort Logan to have some training and then shipped to different places to be trained, different weapons and bazookas that would fire a shell that would penetrate the tanks at that time. And we'd dig foxholes, and the tanks would run over us, but I dug mine, and tank driver wasn't very good, and he got too close to the side, and all the dirt fell in on me, and they had to dig me out.
Well, it could have ended for you right there in training. And it sounds like, unless I'm not getting my story straight, I don't think you would have met your wife, Mary, without World War II sending you to a different part of the country. Is that right?
That sure is right. I was stationed at Peterson Field, and they decided to move all of Peterson Field to Will Rogers in Oklahoma City. And I was a supply sergeant, and myself were the last to leave Peterson and see that everything was shipped on down to Will Rogers, and then I went to Will Rogers and worked for a major there for a while because I was sent up to Fort Collins to learn how to type and other things that a clerk would do. And after I got that, then I was waiting to go to college up there to get this training. They had me clean the latrines with a toothbrush. And I no sooner got up there than I come down with scarlet fever. In those days, they took paper tape and taped all the windows and all the doors. You couldn't get in or out. And a lot of the guys that had scarlet fever, that would sometime affect the heart and cause a heart failure. And so they were discharged right on the spot. Thank goodness I thought I'm well enough that I'm ready to go and still fight in this war. And so the time that I spent in the hospital, I'd ask the nurse if she'd please get me a model airplane kit to build, and she did, and I'd wake up in the next morning or two and no model airplane. She would take that, and I noticed the nurses who thought some of the men were better looking than they were in the bed, and they got more attention than I did.
You never know what kind of stories we're going to hear. And so, to clarify so everyone understands, so you actually started out in the Army Air Corps.
Yes.
And there's a story there too, because you had heard that your eyes might not be good enough for the Army Air Corps to take you, right? And you had a little home remedy to try to address that?
Oh, yes. Before I went in for the see if I would be one selected. Somebody told me that carrots were good and drink carrot juice. And I drank carrot juice and ate carrots, and I thought they was going to come out of my ears. And when I got up there and stood in line for the doctor to come by and examine us, he said, next. So I was so pleased without the carrots that I made the cut.
And so it's in the Army Air Corps that you get sent from Peterson Field here in Colorado to Will Rogers Field in Oklahoma. And how was it that you and Mary met?
Well, most of the guys were hitting the beer joints every night. They had a pass, and I thought a beer joint is no place to find a wife. And so I went to church one night. It was about a mile away. She rode the streetcar, and I belong to the Church of Christ and still do. And so there was one there, and went on a corner, and about two other denominational churches. And so I went Wednesday night by myself, rode out there and went to church. And when it was over, stood in where you catch the streetcar to go back home, and I didn't see any young lady when I was in there because it was so many people in there. And here comes this most beautiful lady I ever saw coming across the street, and she got in the same area I was, and I said, is this where you catch the streetcar? What a dumb thing. She said, yes, it is, to back to town. And so she got on there, and I got on there and sat down beside her and spent the whole time she was living at the ladies' YWCA. And she was living there and working with oil field. And so I finally got her telephone number, and then I would call her every night for a date. And
eventually, she would accept. We're overdue for a break, but we'll hear the rest of that story when we come back, and also what this 101-year-old has on his wall that illustrates a chapter of history that we just cannot allow ourselves to forget. Bruce Elson of Pueblo, Colorado is our guest today. You can find photos and a video with Bruce at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 101-year-old Bruce Elson of Pueblo, Colorado. Maybe you came across him in his years as a volunteer docent at the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum. We're going to hear about what he witnessed in Hiroshima after the atomic bomb in a bit. But when we left off, Bruce was explaining how World War II introduced him to the love of his life, his late wife, Mary.
I finally got a date, and they had a place in Oklahoma City on the main street that a GI could take off his pants and his Eisenhower jacket and have them pressed and look pretty sharp. And so I always did that before I picked her up. And then we'd either go to a movie or do something else. And I'd be with her until even they'd allow you to go up in the building. And they had a visitor's room there. And she and I'd go up there and steal kisses. And here the lady that looked after the area, she'd come by walking by and shake her finger at us. But those were excellent days. And then we became engaged while I was stationed there at Will Rogers. And till then, the Battle of the Bulge in Europe came along and killed so many infantrymen, and they couldn't get any aircraft to drop on the troops. And Hitler thought if he could go to where the U.S. Was unloading all their equipment, he could capture that, and then he could defeat the army. But Patton was not that way. He got his tanks all together and took them, and he was standing right in the middle of them, directing tanks going one way or the other. And he come up behind the Germans with his tanks, and that saved the troops that were still living. And one of the German officers come down to ask the commanding general if he would surrender or have all of his battalion killed, and he said, "Nuts to you." And so he fought it as long as it cleared, and Patton with his tanks took care of it from the rear and killed a great majority of the German army.
Yeah, that was General McAuliffe who said nuts, and my grandfather was one of the men under Patton that was part of that. But because of the casualties that America suffered, they needed to find more infantrymen. You're in the Army Air Corps, but they say, we need you to be an infantryman. So you're going to have to say goodbye to Mary, and you probably have a decision to make, huh?
Well, I really didn't. They just called out the number of people that were sergeants and sent them. I didn't even get a chance to tell Mary goodbye, and put us on the train and sent us to infantry training in Fort Ord. And one of the doctors there saw that I had bad eyesight, and so he said, or I guess he said to himself and the rest of the officers, that that man's not fit to be an infantryman. So they sent me to a heavy weapons company in Fort McClellan, Alabama, and that's where I trained with heavy weapons and bazooka and digging foxholes, and as I mentioned, get run over, and it was all-night hikes. And the best turnover I ever ate in the Army was when we got back from an all-night hike, and he had coffee in those. They were delicious, and I haven't tasted anything like it since.
When I say you had a decision to make, you know, I've talked to a lot of veterans. I think it's been about 50-50. Some of them said, well, I didn't want to get married and then leave her a war widow. And others said, oh, I was, you know, I planned on coming home, so we needed to get married. You're going to be heading overseas. Did you and Mary talk about whether or not you should tie the knot?
I told her I would rather that she wait because I didn't want her to be left as a widow or a widow with children to have to raise on her own. But she answered, she said, we're going to get married right now. So as soon as I finished heavy weapons training, I got off the train, and then I had a 15 days delay en route and to California. It was the best 15 days of my life to be with Mary, but it was terrible to have to say goodbye. And as we got on the troop ship, it wasn't really a troop ship. It was a merchant marine ship, but it still had so many beds. They're stacked about 6 or 7 high down in the hole. And as we sailed out under the bridge, we looked at the Golden Gate and the rail, and we said to each other, I wonder if we'll ever see that again. So we went on down and went to bed and asleep. And the next thing I knew, they had 55-gallon drums at each side and in each length. Everybody was throwing up. They had the drums all filled, running over, and the puke about ankle deep. And so that was... from then on, we slept on top of that deck. We had no mattress or anything else, but we never did go to sleep back in the hole.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned looking at the Golden Gate, wondering if you're going to see it again. But here you got 15 days with your bride, and now you're leaving. Did you think you were going to see her again? What was really going through your mind?
Well, you know, I guess that we had so much confidence in me returning. I just hated to leave her, and I can never forget. Here in Pueblo, we had the most beautiful train depot because it came here and had a roundhouse and then went east. No train ever went any further south. And so there was ticket sellers in that depot, and I never will forget the black shoeshine man. He was the most comical guy you could ever meet, and did shine your shoes while you were waiting for your train, and you could buy food or whatever, and It was just, and so old guy had to leave Marion and get on board because she come back home with my folks until I left. And so I walked that whole length of that train as it pulled out, waving and throwing kisses to Mary and goodbye to my folks. And I don't think I ever felt any worse in my life than when I never lost sight of her and went on to California to go overseas.
You told us how memorable that first day aboard ship was, but how about the other end of that journey? Where did they send you? Where'd you end up?
Well, Lady was the pool for all newcomers. We stopped at any Weetalk or one time, which you could see across, and which the Marines had freed. But there was a old ship out a ways that a few of us said, "Let's swim out and look at that ship." Well, we got about halfway, and the captain of the ship said, "You guys get back to shore." And we turned around and almost drowned, you know, trying to get back. And that stone on those places, if you get cut by one, it takes forever to seal. So we got back on board ship and then went on our way and stood on, never went back in the hole again. And we washed our clothes by tying them to a rope and throwing overboard and let them go through the water. And they were pretty white when we got them, and the old porpoises were jumping beside us like they were leading the way, and we never ran into any storms. I don't know if that was the excellence of the captain of that ship. And here a few years ago, I saw in the paper here, a man died, and he was the captain of the merchant ship that I went overseas. And had I known that he was come from the same time I did, it would have been really something. But he was training a young man to be a captain, and I'd visit with the men that run the ship, and we'd visit at night together. And after I landed at Curry, Japan, why, they took six of us and said, "There's a ship out there in the sea that's the men are trying to overtake the captain." So we got our rifles, and six of us, they shipped us out there to settle the argument. And gosh, we didn't know anything about that. But we boarded the ship and told them to calm down and take orders from the captain and quit doing that. And so finally got them to do that. They maybe get friends again. Then went back to Curry.
Well, and before that, I'm guessing that you got assigned to the 41st Infantry Division as a replacement?
Yes, I did get a little ahead of myself. We landed at the pool, and then one night they called me out and put me on a small, narrow ship that could navigate the rivers in the Philippines. And they said, "Now keep your heads down because there's Japanese out there." And so we quietly spent the night going from one little river to another until we got to where the 41st Infantry Division was put up. They said, "This is where you get off, Elson." So I got off. There was no one to greet me. It was dark as it could be, nobody moving around. They said, "See that tent up there, about three tents, and with the mosquito tent in there, that's where you stay tonight." And so you couldn't have been more lonelier than I was, and have no one greet us, not knowing where to go, and sleep the rest of the night, what little sleep I had, worrying about the Japanese. And finally, I was assigned the 41st Infantry Company M, which was the heavy-duty weapons, and I was chosen to carry the base plate on an 81-millimeter shell ship, and it weighed 81 pounds, and I got the shin splits over and over and over, but I had to do that. I had to carry that wherever we moved to set up to fight the Japanese, and so it's quite an experience to be with the 41st, and then whenever we had a chance to rest, we would write letters to our folks back home and to Mary, and then the officers would read them that I didn't say anything I shouldn't, and I saw the officers cutting out of my letters, and I couldn't write really anything that I wanted to write. Mm-hmm. And so I had to endure all of that. And one night I was sleeping and in the tent and had a bar of candy I put up over, and something come in and grabbed that, and I went out of that tent like crazy because the Japanese were getting hungry. They didn't have any food, and I thought it was maybe one of the Japanese that was trying to steal that. And so that kind of shook me for the rest of the night, and it was pretty strenuous time overseas.
And you've got a photo right behind us here that you carried with you that whole time of Mary to remind you of who was waiting for you back home. I bet you got a letter or two from her while you were over there.
I have two boxes of letters in the next room that she saved every one, and I saved every one, and I got two boxes of letters, of love letters sent back and forth.
What did that do for you? What was the real impact of that?
Oh, well, it was the real impact that I wanted to tell Mary that I was okay, and then I had to find out how she was getting along by herself and living by herself, and it was quite a period of time to have to endure, but the good Lord saw me through.
Amen to that. And I'm looking at a frame over here that's got your dog tags in it and your 41st Infantry Division shoulder patch and a bronze star and a combat infantry badge and some other decorations. That combat infantry badge doesn't come lightly. That means that you were in some situations that might have made it so you didn't get to come home to Mary. Are there some moments that you look back on and you say, yeah, God really was with me there, or that was a pretty close call?
Well, yes. Every time you got close to them, you didn't know where they were or where they're at. But the other infantry companies had them pretty well thinned out by the time that I got there. And it was great that we just had to look. And they'd also, the Japanese soldiers that were still left, a lot of them would commit hara-kiri and not surrender and hide in caves. And so the guys that had the fire burners would burn the holes. And so it was really a difficult time to think that you might not get back, and just had to be so alert at all times.
And I don't want to skip over anything that's important to you, so feel free to insert anything. But as I look around here, another big display on the wall is the Enola Gay. You have Paul Tibbetts, the pilot of the Enola Gay, which was named for his mother. You have his autograph on that photo there. You volunteered for many years at the Pueblo Weisbrod Museum, where they have a B-29 like that, and they have a display with the instruments of surrender that atomic bomb ushered in. But I've got to ask you, do you think that atomic bomb saved your life? Because you guys had some plans that they were going to use you for, didn't they?
Oh, yes. We were supposed to invade November 1. We were supposed to invade Japan. Okinawa, of course, happened before that, and we had thousands and thousands of GIs killed because the general of the Japanese had that island all spaced off so he could fire down and kill thousands and thousands of GIs at the same time. And my brother was a Marine that fought there, and he was wounded and in a tent, and the Japanese dropped a firebomb on a hospital tent, which is canvas. He helped carry the wounded out of the tent to secure it until he fell on his face exhausted. But he finally escaped Okinawa, and Okinawa, we lost thousands and thousands of men. And after we realized that if we had had to invade Japan, they would have every woman and child fight us, and every child would and woman would cut those long bamboo poles and sharpen them, and they called them holes that the mother and their children could get in there, and if we would pass, they'd jump out of that and stab us with those bamboo poles. So we would have lost, just like Okinawa, even more so than Okinawa. And Okinawa was the only island in the war that two generals lost their lives. Of course, the Japanese general, he committed harakiri, and the American general was on the firing line and just raised his head a little bit to see how it was going. The troops were going, and he got shot in the head. So that was the only place that two generals lost their lives.
And it sounds like your brother came pretty close to losing his life. Did you find out about that while you were still over there, or not till you came home? When did you find out your brother had been wounded?
When we went to land in Japan after they dropped the bomb, we stopped at Okinawa, and I was in hopes that I would get to see him, but he had just left to go to China to get the Japanese all out of China. So I didn't get to see him, and we had to stay there till a terrible storm at sea went by. And then we went into Kure, Japan, and we that's the first place that we landed in Japan. And we had they give us three shells for our rifles, and we had to make a tactical landing just like we would going in to fight. But we wondered why MacArthur only give us three shells. We kind of learned that maybe he realized he was a great general. He realized that some of those guys have been fighting for 3 years over there, and they might be still so mad at the Japanese, they might take fire on them and try to kill them.
So that was the explanation for the three-round limit, but there's something else that Bruce Elson can explain in a way that people that weren't there just can't. Hear this 101-year-old's memories from Hiroshima and what he brought back with him when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend. It's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is. Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with razor-sharp 101-year-old Bruce Elson of Pueblo, Colorado. He served in the 41st Infantry Division during World War II. When we left off, Bruce had come ashore in Japan for occupation duty and was soon to see something no one would have ever been able to imagine.
We got there and we were assigned to stay at the Japanese Navy's place where they stayed, but they were still on ship looking down at us. We made a tactical landing there. I had a friend that was in the Army, too, and they cleared the bombs out of the sea, and he said that was quite an experience, getting that all cleared before we went in, and went in company by company and marched down the street to where the Japanese Navy guys stayed, and they, as we marched down or get in there, why, they were all looking down at us from the ship. We said, I hope they didn't fire anything down at us. So we marched down the street, and the people were looking out of their windows, peeking out at the windows marching through their town, and there was a Japanese policeman with his back turned and a sword on his shoulder, and we wondered why that his back was turned toward us and with a sword on his shoulder, and we found out later that that was the Japanese way of respecting the victor. So then we got in the rooms of the place where we stayed. It had no running water. It had no latrines or anything modern in those places where we stayed. So we had to go back out on the pier, and that's what we used as urinal place. But you know, when MacArthur was such a great general, when he went into Tokyo the same time we went in, he never went to the emperor's palace, but he let the emperor come to him, and that's where they decided to make the peace, and MacArthur said, I will not come and stay in your place to live. The Japanese people were a people, if whatever the emperor said, they did. When they said they were going to war, they went to war full blast. And he said, the war's over, we're at peace. You wouldn't find a Japanese person that was not peaceable. The kid, I went out the next morning, and also the Japanese adults were, I couldn't move, for they were surrounding me and the little children. The men were begging cigarettes, and because in our rations, we got 2 to 4 packages of cigarettes with our food. They knew that, and they were begging for us to give them our cigarettes. Well, I didn't smoke, so I gave my cigarettes to them. We had a little bit of candy, chocolate candy in there, and I gave the children the candy I had. And from that point on, I walked into the cities and looked around, and not once was I afraid of a Japanese soldier back from the war attempting to still try to kill me. I did see one time there was a full uniformed Japanese soldier back from China. He was buying candy from, or something, cigarettes from a GI, and then he was all over that guy, fellow Japanese. But he never did pay attention to the Americans around him. We went to another little town, Fukuyama, to destroy the sea weapons, the airships and all, and my company did, and we stayed there till it was time for me to have enough points to come home. I walked out in the farmer's field trying to find something in the way of clothing or something to send my wife, and I met a farmer out there, and I said, "Do you speak English?" And he says, "Yes, I was trained in English in the USA." And I was really set back on that answer. But the Japanese were so poor at the end of the war, they didn't have anything really. They were really poor.
Well, and there was some real devastation that you're one of the only people still around who witnessed it firsthand. Because 6 weeks after the Enola Gay dropped that bomb, little boy, you were there in Hiroshima. You have photos of it on your wall, and you actually have an artifact, a few of them, that you picked up there in Hiroshima. Tell me what you saw there, what it felt like, and what you brought back with you.
Well, Saturday after my division took, after parade and inspection, why they turned us loose and we could go do anything we wanted. So we were walking out wondering where we'd go or what we would do. And a GI and a truck come by and he says, "Would you like to go to Hiroshima?" And we had never really heard of, they never told us really about Hiroshima, nor did they, radiation was not in our vocabulary. We didn't know a thing about radiation. They never told us, the officers and then the service, they never mentioned that. So, yeah, we'd like to go. And so we drove about 20 miles, I guess. And with, you know, the whole city was surrounded by a wooden fence like you see and we have in our homes, in the backyard or to separate housing that we use. And it was just surrounded, but you look back on that wood and it was discharged. And that's where the heat and the fire stopped. So we drove on in a little farther and got out of the truck and started looking for things. And I found this sake bottle. It was twisted and melted, but yet it was not broken. So I picked that up to bring home as a souvenir. And then I wore glasses since the fourth grade. And that time, even the civilian eye doctors here in town, Dr. Hopkins, he'd put these rims on your nose, and then he had a desk that had lenses in them, and he'd pick one up, and he'd put it on, and he'd have me look through, and then he'd get another. Is this better or worse? And that's how I was fitted for glasses in the fourth grade. And then I saw this exact thing laying at my feet as I kicked the rubbish. Here was the specs that they put on the Japanese and the lenses that they put in, just like that I was fitted. And I couldn't get over how the similarity was. I wanted to bring some of that back, but that was just too heavy with glass and all to pick up and or break off to bring back. So I had to leave it there. I looked for stuff to send Marion with, clothing. Hardly could find anything. And they walked around and took a picture as we went in of the city and the three buildings that still stood. And they still were standing because the Japanese had a thing in their cities that if they built a building higher than one level, it had to be strong enough to stand the heaviest earthquake that would hit Japan. But that's why the three buildings that were still standing, there was two store buildings and one bank, and that's why they were still building, standing. So then from that spot that I was with the company, and I was head of the company at that time, we just drove the truck to town to get supplies. And crazy truck driver I had, the Japanese fertilize their crops with human dung, and they'd be one on each shoulder with a board to the where they were carrying it. And this silly driver would run them off the road. They had it. That splashed all over the place. Oh, no. So anyway, I was stationed there till I had enough points that I could go home.
I do want to hear about your reunion with Mary, but I think I just have to ask you because, you're 101 years old and you're one of the last people alive that saw that devastation at Hiroshima firsthand. And you have that photo on the wall. You have the sake bottle on the wall. You have some melted coins that you picked up there on the wall. Your account was part of a traveling exhibit from the National Archives to preserve this history. So when you see that now, when you see that blue melted sake bottle on the wall and the pictures of what it looked like there, what comes to mind, and what do you think we need to know about it now? What perspective should we all have on that moment in history?
Well, it was so great you couldn't really comprehend it. First, just go and see the regular things and then see that, and not a person walking around, just rubble everywhere you went. And things laying there. It was just hard to comprehend. When on that one building, when I got back home, I saw when they rebuilt that city. There's a book that I read about the rebuilding. There was still some people that lived there that still resented that desolation. And there was one German that ran a hospital there, and there when that was, they were bombing, they were about to kill him until he claimed that he was a German there with a hospital kind of thing. It just was overwhelming, and I have a picture of that one building that had a dome on it, and it now is the... over the gateway into the museum there in Hiroshima, and it's been built, and you look at it today, you'd never know that it was nothing but rubble.
Yeah, and you didn't have to invade Japan. Maybe the bomb saved your life, but what we know for sure is that you got to come home and see that wife that you'd only had 15 days of marriage with before you headed overseas. What was that reunion like with Mary?
I told her I was back in the States. I wrote that letter to her, or called her, I guess. And I said, I'll be catching the train, and I'll be home at a certain day, or at the depot a certain day. So we pulled into the station, and there she was, standing there, and two other ladies that she boarded with. And there she was, and I got off of that train and had that doggone duffel bag stuffed full of my belongings, and I drop that thing and run to her and give her a big kiss, and oh, it was just had nothing to do but thank God that I made it back. It was just the greatest moment in my life.
Well, and your life's still going. People can hear how sharp you are, how with it you are, how active you are at 101 years old. You told me you entered the Army at Fort Logan. You were discharged at Fort Logan. You're going to be buried there someday. Mary's been buried there since 2016. But when you think back over 101 years and counting, is there something that you would say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Meeting Mary the other time, and then being on the rifle team with an ROTC, and that was a highlight. And when we graduated in the city auditorium here, it was nothing like graduation for kids today. We sat in seats, and when you called your name, you walked down, picked up your diploma, walked back and sat down. Then when you were dismissed, you run down and got in some old Model T or Model A with some friends of yours and dragged up and down Main Street yelling and back and forth. And just one of the highlights of getting out of school.
Well, and one other thing I have to ask you, I guess, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. You've got a lot in your rearview mirror, and you're a car guy. You probably sold a lot of rearview mirrors as the parts manager at the Oldsmobile dealership. But is there something you haven't done yet in 101 years that you would still love to be able to check off that list?
Well, I don't know. A year ago, I was getting gas. You know, there's always a line. You have to wait. And so there was a guy that was filling, and I would be next. So I turned my motor off and sat there, and here he got filled, and then he got in his car, started it, and started to go. Well, I didn't look at him anymore, and I just looked at the gas pump to line the fuel line to my gas tank. And the next thing I bump, and he had stopped, and he come over and got my insurance number, drove off, and I said, well, I didn't even have a dent in my front of my car, and he didn't have a dent in his back car, and he drove off, and I said, well, we got it. I didn't see you, but he sued the company for $3,000. And so that day I was dosing out here in Pueblo at the aircraft museum. And from that day on, I quit driving and I gave up my job as a docent at there. So that was kind of a real letdown. And I had to wait a year for that to be settled, so I didn't drive. And the company I worked for 44 years, Vidmore Mathis, they took my car. They were nice enough to take it back and sell it and to give me quite a bit of money for it. And so I haven't driven since or been a docent out there. And I miss those things. And I talk to my children every night. They're good to get groceries for me and take care of the needs that I can't do. And so it's a good life, and I just kind of live the old days. but I don't get depressed, thank goodness, and don't feel bad with things that I had to do, and glad everything's over in my life. And think of the young people now that waste their lives on doing things that are contrary to civilization. But that, I guess, we have to go through, and it's quite a time.
Well, I know this may sound like a goofy question, but maybe you've got a good answer for me. If there's somebody listening and they hear you, they say, man, I want to be like that when I'm 101. What advice would you have for them?
Well, the best advice I give to them would be live a clean life for the spouse and the children, and quit smoking and drinking. And I think those two things people sometimes overdo, and it certainly doesn't prolong your life. So, and then such a good life that we had together, and the children, how they were so successful in life and have their own families now and still instilling the things that they learned in them. So I feel like it's a life firsthand that right that I lived.
And continues to live at age 101 in Pueblo, Colorado. Again, you'll find photos and a short video with Bruce on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That's all the time we have today, but thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.